Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to episode 256. Today I'm joined by Emmett Peppers. Welcome, Emmett.
Hey Dave, how are you doing? How's it going down in Austin? Are you recovering from the weather or?
Yeah, I mean it's been a crazy week. Luckily, at our house right here, we haven't actually had any outages with electricity or water, but the whole city, over half the people have been without either electricity and water for like almost a week or so. It's crazy.
It's nuts.
So, I mean, like over half the people for like 3 or 4 days didn't have electricity. And then now three or four days, people aren't having any water. And so, it's just crazy. I mean, I have friends and just been keeping up to date and it's just insane. It's scary because if this would have lasted like another week or so, the weather, it would have just, I mean, it would have been a it's already a complete disaster even right now. Like it's still, people are still recovering. Like for example, like we know a bunch of people whose pipes are just bursted and their houses are flooded and everything. It's just insane. It's like, there must be literally thousands of people's houses whose plumbing is just shot, you know?
And yeah, I've seen stories of people's like pipes bursting from being frozen and water, you know, just such a, I guess there's going to be a lot of demand for plumbers probably.
Plumbing. Seriously. Yeah. A lot of stuff.
Generators and all that.
Today. So we have a bunch of topics. So I posted on Twitter asking people for questions. And so I've got about 10 or 15 great questions I wanted to discuss with you. But first I wanted to talk about kind of Tesla and, we'll start from there, kind of the stock price, our thoughts, and we'll move into some more Tesla, some Elon Musk and Bitcoin, and something called NFTs, non-fungible tokens. We'll move into SpaceX, Clubhouse, your foundation, venture capital, just general lessons on investing, beginner tips, and then business ideas. So we got some fun stuff here. So first off, Tesla had a down week last week. And so we're in the 780s or so. And ever since, you know, a couple weeks ago, it seems like there's been a little bit of that momentum kind of, you know, sucked out of the stock. What's your current take on things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's natural to consolidate, and I think the buying of the Bitcoin spurred more institutional selling than institutional buying. You know, maybe some retail, you know, people bought on that news, but I would say there's probably some institutions that weren't so happy and might, you know, the old school mindset of portfolio managers who don't approve of Bitcoin, for example, you know, if they're kind of on the fence already about Tesla and they have to buy some, maybe they're like, ah, let's trim our Tesla positions or whatever. So that's my feeling. But also they're consolidate. It's just natural to consolidate, and stocks don't only go up, you know, they go down too. We've seen that with Tesla, you know, over the years. And so, you know, I get a little worried. You know, I see people from time to time on Twitter, like, you know, especially people, you know, putting my name in their tweet saying like, yeah, I'm going to buy a whole bunch of calls, like Emmett Peppers did, you know, and make a fortune, you know. And I'm like, man, this is not a good time to do it, in my opinion. You know, we've already gone up tenfold, 10 times in the last year or 18 months. Like, you know, it seems, you know, not like a good, I could be wrong, but it just seems like pure gambling right now to try to buy calls on Tesla, you know. To my mind, you know, maybe you flip the coin in its heads and you do all right, but I think I'm actually more on the side of selling out of the money calls, you know, or selling out of the money puts, you know, when it's going down. You know, I think the options are expensive right now. That's my thought. I mean, what do you think about the Tesla price movement? What's your kind of take personally on it? Like,
I mean, I was kind of actually expecting a bit of a loss of momentum. I think the Bitcoin thing is a bit, people underestimate the controversialness of the controversy of Bitcoin with institutional investors. Now, retailers generally, like, they're happy with it, you know, but it poses a different, completely different set of questions, you know, and concerns, I think, for institutional investors. also we had like, I mean, I'm curious to hear also your take on rising interest rates. So we have the 10-year treasury bond going up significantly over the past few weeks. And so, you know, some people are saying, hey, there's some movement out of growth stocks because, hey, the interest rates go up. And so when interest rates were like super low, right, you didn't have, I guess, the appeal of just, let's say, interest bearing or even safer stocks. But then now with interest rates creeping back up, the appeal of growth stocks might have lost a little bit of its sheen. What kind of credence do you give to that? And how do you kind of process all that?
No, I absolutely think they're correlated. And I think, you know, if interest rates continue to go up, you know, I think it's like 1.3 or a little more than that, maybe for the 10-year, that went up to like 1.5 or 2%. I think absolutely the growth stocks are going to be hit hard. You know, right now it could be people kind of a combination of just people speculating as the interest rates are going up slowly that like, hey, this is going to hit hard. Let's just rotate out of these growth stocks right now that have this huge discount, you know, built into them in the future. So yeah, there's truth to that. You know, I think, you know, Tesla, you know, that's what we talk about. That's what we know the most. And they're sort of grouped in that bucket, but not as much as they used to be, you know, and they're still a growth stock, but it's not like now that they're part of the S&P 500, now that they're, you know, revenues are driving, you know, people are starting to see it as like a real company that's going to provide a ton of revenues. It's hopefully it won't be hit as hard as the other growth stocks, you know, if that happens, but it'll recover over time. And that's why I think the long-term call options, it's not a good risk reward right now, you know, to me, because if this hit comes, Tesla could go to like 400 or 500, you know, and could kind of wobble between 500 and 700 or 800 for a long time. You know, people buying like $1,000 call options, even like 2 years out, they might be out of luck. Who knows? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, people generally like they hope that their investments go up. And I think a lot of times that can affect kind of their decisions where like they really think that like it's going to go up because, you know, they see the past has gone up and they think, oh, it's going to go up. They convince themselves, right, that there's so many reasons why it can go up. But yeah, it's like, I think one thing is just the whole thing of trying to separate hope and emotions from just objective reality. You know, there's something where, hey, the stock did like a 10x or more, you know,
yeah. And that's insane. Yeah.
In yeah. It's insane. Months,
it's like, yeah. And I'm not going to do that again for a while.
Exactly. Right? And now people want a quick double. Right. It could be tough, right? I mean, that's just objective.
Yeah, reality. If it doubles from here, think about it. If it doubles from here, that means it went 20x in 18 months.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. For a small cap stock, you know, that's one thing, but for, you know,
yeah.
One of the largest, the most valuable companies in the world for them to do that is crazy. Definitely interesting stuff. I mean, have you heard, did you see Elon Musk's, recent Twitter profile change?
Yeah, I did. I saw he changed it twice, once to Bitcoin and then just today, like to a fork in the road.
Yes.
Right.
So did you have any ideas on the fork? Yeah. I mean, I think
it could have something to do with his cryptocurrency speculation right now. I think like he's probably thinking maybe there's a fork in the road with like his decision about Dogecoin and making his own cryptocurrency, for example, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Or it could be about Bitcoin or something else, but I don't think it's that. That's more of a Tesla SpaceX thing. But him personally, what he believes with the cryptocurrency, I think there's a fork in the road in his thinking. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was like, what, the fork? But then I was reading some of the comments and, you know, some people are saying that it could be a fork, meaning he's hard forked Dogecoin, meaning he's basically, you know, with certain cryptos, you can fork him and you basically are creating another version of it. And if he puts his money behind it and tries to basically take over or, you know, create another new Dogecoin for whatever. I mean, it's interesting because it seems like this crypto stuff is really on his mind. I mean, it seems like it's not just, you know, something that it's just passing, and he's really getting into it. One of his tweets was saying that him and his kids bought some, mining computers, right, off of eBay.
Saw that.
Yeah, to mine some project. Dogecoin. That's like, you're pretty into it by then, you know?
He's pretty into it. Yeah, he's really, he's already been into it. He's a super smart guy. He understands it better than anyone thinks he does. People like say, oh, Elon doesn't understand, blah, blah, blah. No, of course he understands it better than anyone else speculating on it, probably. You know, yeah. Like this guy's like the smartest guy alive right now. Like who's going to say he doesn't, and think that's, I think it's a fork in the road. It's obvious, that's what the picture is, but a fork in the road of what?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to, definitely see. I mean, in the next few weeks, what's going to happen.
Like he's at a decision point. Like he's got to make a decision, like this or that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think it's something. Definitely fork. I mean, for software developers, a fork is a clear indication that something's happening with software. You know, he's doing something, but we'll see. Let's go into some Twitter questions. First off, we have Anthony. Do you think the recent events in Texas may accelerate the adoption of self-energy generation and storage in the state? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I sure hope so. I think there'll be more demand from the homeowners. I'm not sure the government would act so quick to change something to accelerate it, but I think the demand from the actual consumer will go up for power walls and such, but and generators and stuff. That's what I think. I don't think it's enough to make the governor of Texas and the assembly, or the state assembly lawmakers, like make a big move yet. Not like we've seen in Australia, for example, or whatnot. What do you think? Do you think it's going to, you're down there.
I know.
What do you hear about? I mean, in Austin, you probably hear all about it. It's like the blue city in the red state,
Yeah. I mean, so I'll unpack some of this stuff. I mean, it's fascinating. So several things are going on with Texas. First, it's got its own grid that's not really connected to the Western grid and has limited connections to other grids. So it's very independent. And then it's very privatized. So a lot of these power plants, they're private companies. So they're not really, government entities per se. So they have a choice of what to do. And so in Texas's case, these power plants, they didn't winterize. So they didn't expect weather to get so cold. And in Texas, this past week, we got down to, I think, probably like 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, Fahrenheit, right, for a few days. And this is like record temperatures. No one was prepared. And so what happened was these natural gas power plants, a lot of them couldn't function. They just couldn't get the gas. And Texas doesn't store a lot of gas, so they get them. They have to mine it right off the bat, and all of their equipment is frozen. They can't get gas, et cetera. So you've got this, the power plants, their production just crashed when it went under 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the demand spiked because 60% of Texas supposedly heats their homes with electricity. And wow. So when these two things happen, they had to just shut down the grid, because if they didn't shut down the grid, what would happen is it would explode. They would just blow up the grid. But once it blows up, like in a significant way, it could take months to recover the grid. I mean, it's pretty crazy. So they tried to avert disaster, but what happened was they promised people, oh, we're going to do rolling blackouts. But they weren't in the position to do rolling blackouts because, the supply was so low, demand was high, et cetera. And they basically shut down power for, like, for example, here in Austin, over like half the people didn't have power for like over 3 days. Inside their houses, they were getting to like in the 30s of, it was like freezing. People with babies and kids and just like...
I saw some stories. Yeah,
it was insane. I mean, it got me really thinking hard about what's going on.
Were people burning a lot of fires outside to like go out and stay warm?
Not really. I mean, at least here in Austin, people don't really burn fires. I mean, I guess some people had firewood for their fireplaces, but I mean, it's kind of crazy. But I think generally speaking, there's this kind of crisis where in extreme events, things break down, but they break down in just crazy ways, and the government is not there to help you. It's like you're on your own, basically.
Yeah.
And it's scary because, like, think about it. Imagine if you are 3 or 4 days and your house is under 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and you have no, let's say, no electricity, let's say your water is shut off, like you're running out of food, you don't, you know, you don't to do. This is the reality of a lot of people in Texas this past week. And it was like a wake-up call, at least for me, where I'm like, man, it's like, we've got to take some things in our own hands, you know? Like, I wasn't thinking about solar or Powerwall or whatever, but then I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like, I think it's almost like a necessity now. And especially with kind of extreme weather events, like this stuff doesn't seem like it's slowing down. And so, yeah, it's been definitely a wake up call for this, for me this past week. So we'll see. Next question is from Rich. He says, hi, could you perhaps talk about how likely would it be for Tesla to acquire other EV companies, say FUV or the likes, sometime in the future? Would it make sense? What are your thoughts?
I don't think so. I don't think Tesla wants to, I don't think it makes sense for them to buy other companies. I think it would be hard to integrate completely other systems, software. You know, the company is a whole bunch of different systems and software and processes and culture, right? Trying to suddenly integrate a big company into Tesla, you know, that's a headache and a half. Like, you know, I see that as like companies that have no other choice, like GM merging with Ford eventually or something like that. You know, like I could see Volkswagen buying, you know, merging with Fiat or something, you know, things like that happening for the companies that don't have much other choice but to try something, you know, to boost their shareholder value, even though long term. So I don't think they're going to buy other EVs. You know, doesn't seem to make sense. They're the leaders. There's no reason. There's nothing special about these other, you know, the Grohmann manufacturing. Yeah, that was like first specific for manufacturing, you know, or, you know, sometimes they might buy like a special battery, you know, maker or something like that. It has some special IP they want. But in terms of another electric car company, I highly doubt it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I have nothing to add to that. No value add, I think. I think a lot of times, I think Tesla can acquire, I think, stuff like in the battery supply chain. It kind of makes sense if it can guarantee kind of a higher battery production or lower cost, etc. Like that type of acquisition kind of makes sense, or even just locking down long-term contracts for certain, you know, key materials and stuff. I think that's probably a better use of their time or money too. Kevin from Twitter says, can you unpack some of your takeaways from Bitcoin and DeFi this past few weeks? Does the bull thesis of the dollar will fail and Bitcoin will be the only answer really hold up? Or is it working now just because of fear around inflation? And there's a few other, there's a bunch of Bitcoin questions from viewers. Anthony Cooper says, I'm curious if Emmett Pepper's views on Bitcoin are any different today versus 12 months ago. And Steve Foxy says, would selling Bitcoin position, Tesla's Bitcoin position now and using tax credits blow first quarter expectations and be a good thing? So, anyways, any kind of recent thoughts on Bitcoin? Has your thoughts evolved or changed in recent weeks or recent months?
Yeah, no, I still think it's kind of this mind virus that's getting everyone by storm. And I think, I think there's a good case for it to become digital gold. You know, I don't think it's going to be more than that. But being digital gold can be incredible. You know, I think gold is like 7 trillion total in the market, you know, and digital gold right now, Bitcoin's 1 trillion. So it could go up a lot still over the long term, if it takes over the entire case from physical gold, let's say. And I see now that institutions are kind of dabbling. That's a big wind at the back of the price potentially stabilizing or going up more. And, in my personal account, actually, I put on this kind of experimental trade with Bitcoin futures where I bought some and I'm trying to, it's called the scale trader with Interactive Brokers. I'm trying to just provide liquidity sort of in this $50,000 to $60,000 range where every time it goes up 500 or 1,000, I sell one. And if it goes down 500, I buy one. And it's just kind of printing money for as long as it stays between 50 and 60,000, you know, slowly but surely. And so I kind of think there's a chance that we could stay between 50 and 60,000 for a while. And I also think there's a good case that we could just rapidly get up to 100,000 plus pretty quickly. And, you know, if enough institutions start snowballing into it, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. That's, You've talked to a ton of, I listened to the Cardano guy. He's
Okay,
brilliant, that guy.
yeah.
He perked my interest a lot. Like, some of these guys have really good solutions, and it just depends if it can really take hold and get a huge adoption, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What do you think after doing all your research? You must have evolving views on this stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm curious what so what was your impression about Charles Hoskinson in that interview?
Yeah, I have like the last 10 minutes to listen to
Okay,
still.
yeah.
But the rest of the interview, I listened to most of it. He personally, like a lot of these podcasts I like to listen to, I like to do multitasking, and I'll like cook some food while I'm doing it, or like, do some work while I'm listening to someone, and I still can understand. But this guy talks so concisely and has such brilliant ideas, like, about things that I feel like I was trying to multitask during parts of it, and it was like I couldn't absorb everything because he put so much insight into short sentences or something. It's like you have to really pay attention to what he's saying, like, to really absorb it all. I feel like there's no like wasted words, or he's just a very smart guy and understands his stuff. And I thought that the system he's kind of put together with Cardano, kind of being, a big step above Ethereum, and having like the self-governing principles being built into it. I thought that's, obvious. It seems like that's the obvious route you got to do. But then I also think, like, well, you need a lot of people to adopt to it. You got to, put this into act. I haven't looked into it enough, but in theory, everything he was saying sounded like it just fits, but I haven't gone beyond that. Just it opened my mind up to like the theories he's putting out there as being like the correct ones.
Yeah, it's interesting. Did you catch actually his comments on Bitcoin and how he thinks Bitcoin could die?
He did. I remember he said it. I heard that part.
Yeah.
What was his, he was saying, what was the reason for Bitcoin dying? I
Yeah,
remember him talking about
so
that.
it kind of it was okay, so the interview with Charles, it was interesting because on a lot of levels, I really connected with his thinking. Like I really think that he's on another level. And one of the things is, like, for example, he's really seeing that the blockchains of today are really just, they've got tons of problems. And they aren't scalable. They've got a lot of issues. They need more features. They need better governance, all sorts of stuff. And what he's doing is he's literally just taking the biggest problems and he's just focusing like efforts on those biggest problems to try to solve those problems. And I don't hear anyone, at least I'm aware of, I mean, there's tons of people in the crypto space working on lots of problems, but he's doing it like on a very ambitious scale. Like it's hard to find someone like more ambitious than him, but he's doing it, I think, the right way, where he's isolating the key problems, and he's really trying to solve them. But like with Bitcoin, his whole thesis is this, which is controversial. I'm sure many people kind of missed over it because it wasn't about Bitcoin, the whole interview. But so his thesis is Bitcoin only has value because people are attributing value to it, but Bitcoin is like old technology, in his opinion. It's just an old blockchain. It doesn't carry like
Remember him saying
the
that,
new
yeah.
tech that it needs to really add more value in the future. So in his opinion, once a crypto, which is a new generation crypto, flips Bitcoin in terms of market cap value. So let's say Bitcoin does go up even more. Let's say it's at 2 trillion, I don't know what, 3 trillion, whatever. But at a certain point, who knows what that point is? It could be in a year, it could be 5 years or whatever. But at a certain point, when another crypto, which has better features and better value proposition and more developers, more apps, more ecosystem, all this stuff, eventually tips Bitcoin's market cap, then he says everyone will flip. Everyone will ditch Bitcoin because it doesn't have its value proposition anymore, as a store of value, because there's other, cryptos is taking that place. And so, I mean, he used strong words like Bitcoin will die, but I took it as more like it's gonna go down. It'll probably still stick around, in some form. But yeah, there will be, in his opinion, a new blockchain you know, king in town. And it's very controversial, you know, a lot of Bitcoin folks, like, you know, really, you know, get riled up with that. But in some ways, it makes sense to me, you know, it's like the best blockchain will win, right? I mean, it makes sense. I mean, a lot of Bitcoiners will think no one can beat Bitcoin. Bitcoin is forever, right? Yeah. It is the first and the last, you know, the beginning and the end. But that's not the story of history. It's not the story of technology and innovation.
Yeah.
You know, it's always new things come, and there's financial motivation. There's lots of motivations to try to take out the winner. And it seems like, you know, in some ways, Bitcoin is kind of sitting on its laurels, like, you know, it isn't innovating at all much, because it's just in its
I remember core. His argument about that. Yeah. And like he said, there was problems with like the developer community of Bitcoin not being able to decide on certain things, and you got to build in more governance into this, you know. So I think in theory his stuff is correct, but in reality, I'm not sure his theory will come true. You know, theory and what happens in reality are different things a lot, and academia versus the real world, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's possible, but it has so much first mover advantage as a digital gold, you know, it's hard to reverse that or overcome that as a store of value. I think other cryptocurrencies will become big and popular. Mm-hmm. Maybe another one will, you know, be much more functional, you know, like Ethereum and stuff is right now, and with NFTs and all this other stuff. But I don't know. I don't see Bitcoin being dethroned as digital gold anytime soon. Just as that scarcity, it's just the scarcity. It's like, that's all you need, the scarcity. You know, who cares if it takes 5 minutes to transact or an hour even to transact? You know, it's super efficient in terms of being able to push it across the globe in minutes or whatever, you know, and for almost no money, you know, like take it across borders, you know. It just seems that that's the case for digital gold. Like, what else do you want from a gold, right? Like a scarcity asset, right? So I don't know. I understand what he was saying on that, and that perked my interest, but digital gold, I don't see being something else other than Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Do you, have you been following the cyberpunks, the collectible NFTs at all? Have you seen that?
I saw a guy tweet on it, you know, this guy I follow who's like friends with personally with Elon. I don't know. I've started following a long time ago, but I get Bill Lee or something. He tweets on these. He's always like the forefront of some things like this, which is interesting. I like, and he was tweeting about the cyberpunks and how something just sold for like 1.something million worth of Ethereum or something. And I was like, what? And I tweeted back, or I retweeted, I was like, how do we know this isn't like someone just buying it from himself to like try to prop up the price, you know? And apparently there's a whole story behind the whole cyberpunk, you know, avatar. I don't know all about it, but it just seems like from every direction there's these new digital collectibles, and it's hard to know, you know, with these non-fungible tokens, which ones are here to stay and which ones are just kind of a fad, you know, or maybe subject to some type of fraud of people, you know, painting the tape, like in the stock market or something, trying to make the price look higher than it really should be or something. Mm-hmm. So that others buy it at that price, you know. There's going to be a lot of fraud in that space. And I mean, there is in the art world, you know, in the physical world of art collection too, but that's been around for millions of thousands of years, collecting art, you know, more tens of thousands of years, you know. And so there's all these processes, all these things built in place, you know, to kind of look for that and protect from that. But there's nothing really built in place in the digital world for that yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had a few questions actually from viewers. So Resmi Ram says, non-fungible tokens and their impact on intellectual property and how it can or not give artists a chance at making a living. And Jason Brand says NFTs, talk about NBA Top Shot, CryptoPunk, et cetera. Did you take a look at NBA Top Shot at all, that website?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fascinating. They've had a great success. They're one of the first movers in this space. I think Dapper Labs, right? And they did CryptoKitties, which was popular, you know, and I watched a video on that the other day with my son, who loves kittens, and he was so fascinated with the CryptoKitties like idea and stuff. So I could see certain things taking off that are like early first movers. But I don't, you know, I think there's gonna like anyone can say they're an artist. Like pretty soon you have like AI being able to create like digital art, you know, and you probably won't, we won't be able to tell who, if a person created or some computer program created that art, you know, and then it'll create digital fungible you know, non-transferable, non-fungible tokens. I mean, you know, they'll create all these NFTs for all these like things. It's gonna be, it's a whole new industry perhaps, but it also just seems like everyone and their mom can try to sell something unique, you know, that they can slap a unique token on for and try to make a market for it somehow online. It just seems like it's so hard to just, it reminds me of the ICO craze. Remember that in 2017 with the it just reminds me of how like every day there was like these new coin offerings, and it was like, this coin offering is good for that, this coin offering is good for this, these are all, it's crazy. And I was like, this is nuts, like these aren't gonna take off. Bitcoin's gonna stick around, and maybe Ethereum, maybe Litecoin or whatever, but you know, it just reminds me of that. What do you think about it?
So for those who are confused right now, so these NFTs or non-fungible tokens, they're basically
Yes.
A concept where you take some digital artwork and you make it unique by putting it on the blockchain to make ensuring its uniqueness, and then you sell this digital artwork or collectible item, and people are able to trade these items. And so Cyberpunks was kind of one of the first ones where it was basically 1,000, was it 1,000 or 10, I forget, 1,000 or 10,000 avatars, and kind of block looking avatars, and people are buying them for like a lot, you know, right now. And now,
Apparently, yeah.
and then you've got this, you know, Dapper Labs, which created NBA Top Shot. They're basically digital trading cards. Have you, I'm curious, did you ever trade? I think you did, right? Did you collect baseball
Yeah.
cards at all?
I collected baseball cards for sure. And you know, as a kid, you know. But as a grown up, I haven't collected any. I know a couple, I actually know a guy who collects NBA cards. He has like a bunch of Luka Doncic rookie cards that have made a lot of money for him, you know. So I guess there's some, you know, adults that, you know, collect cards too, and now there's a market for the digital cards, and I guess we'll see how far it goes.
Actually, I have a friend from childhood where we collected cards together and traded, and he just pinged me like last year out of the blue, and he's like, "Oh man, are you still into baseball cards? You know, they're going wild." Like, supposedly there's actually a big industry with lots of different cards.
It's
But
jumping. Yeah, it's going crazy. Yeah.
but this NBA Top Shot is interesting. It's digital kind of NBA cards where you own kind of like a limited kind of run of a special shot, right? And it's a video shot,
Like
and
a highlight or
highlight.
something.
And
Yeah.
it's actually super fascinating to me. So here's a couple angles. One is, I think people are dying to have something unique. You know, I think there's something about this world where, you know, people are grouped into just like, I don't know, they're just lost in a sense. And you have these, you know, celebrities and influencers, and it becomes this thing where I don't know, I think people want something just to hold on to, a value, something
Yeah.
unique. And so if you can say, "Hey, I've got these type of, you know, unique items, and they're known," and it's like, "Wow, how did you get that?" Right? I mean, that's something I think people are yearning for. I think it's just something in our society, in our age of in day and age, that it hits a need of something deeper, of significance, of something, you know. And so as crazy it might sound, I think there definitely is a big market here. You know, I think that there is an enduring market. The issue is kind of like, who are going to be the big winners? Is it going to go through a big hype, you know, kind of stage and crash and then establish itself or whatever? I mean, you do have people. I was watching Bill Lee's Twitter account. He's a friend of Elon, and he's really into NFTs. I actually asked him to come on my show for an interview because I want to figure this out. You know, it's like,
That'd be awesome,
what's
yeah.
going on?
Yeah.
He's kind of reserved to be public right now, he says. But and then you have Chamath Palihapitiya going saying he's getting into NFTs. He's buying a bunch of this digital collectible stuff, and he's going to make a big announcement in a few months, right? Which is going
Yeah.
to pump everything up even more. So yeah, it's
isn't there just some exchange that the NFTs are rolling off of? The Winklevi twins put some exchange together where they roll off these NFTs, I forget what it's called, but there's some some website where they're coming out where they get announced. It's like a auction site or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's multiple versions actually, multiple big springing of all this NFT stuff. But definitely a feel to watch. I'm curious definitely about the field. Let's move on to go for it.
One thing I want to say on that is the NFT, I can see a good case for it in connecting it to real world stuff physical real estate or even stock certificates, or car ownership. I can see a good case for it and that stuff. But when you put it into the digital world, it just seems like there's endless possibilities where, each individual thing is scarce, but there's just an endless amount of scarce things. Like, what is it? Is it scarce or not? Like, it's almost like a conundrum. Like, you create a unique piece of art, so that's the one piece, or maybe there's 10 pieces of them, 10 of, 1,000 of the CryptoPunks, but then you have an infinite amount of those types of things out there that are all scarce in their own, category digitally, yeah. And so it's like, on one hand, it's scarcity, but on the other hand, it's total, complete, infinite abundance. So it's like hard to compute for me as staying in value, except for maybe a few first movers or something that everyone clings to.
I think, so one angle to that is, I think it's going to be tied to more personality and the person, the creator, who's the creator. So just like kind of traditional art is tied to the creator. So you're going to tie it to the value you place in the creator themselves, right? And it doesn't have to be just, for example, artwork. It could be, for example, hypothetically, let's say, I release, 10 tokens per year or 10 digital artworks per year. But let's say it's linked to one of my episodes. Let's say it's an episode art piece, right? Let's say every episode I do is a linked art piece, but there's only one of them, right? And someone might want to buy that art piece, because there's only one of them and it's linked to this one episode, right? And maybe for example, my wife was commenting, she wants to buy a call options on certain YouTube channels, right? But because, she believes in certain trajectories. But then that's the thing. If you really believe in a person's trajectory, right, you want to have a piece of that, or you just want to support and have a piece of that. And so it's very tied to the actual creator as well, right?
Yeah.
And so
it's like buying stocks in a way. Like, you want to buy the stocks you think have a high trajectory.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
yeah,
there's only a limited amount of that stock available.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, imagine your favorite creator is only creating 10 things or 20 things per year. And they're linked to representing something, and you get it, have a shot at it. It's kind of not bad.
I agree with that, but the only thing I would say is okay. In an analogy of the stocks, there's 10,000 stocks in the U.S. you could pick from right now. But in this space, next year there's going to be a million stocks suddenly, and the year after there's going to be a billion stocks to pick from. It's just going to exponentially increase, and it just seems kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, I could see that too. I just think that, there's definitely, I think people want though a piece of something. They're hungry.
They do. Yeah, there's a need for that.
Yeah,
there's desire.
There's definitely, something.
Human nature desire for that, for sure.
I think that's the thing. A lot of these early social games, like when Zynga and all these games popped up in Facebook, a lot of it was, there are different game mechanics, but one of them was collecting. You're collecting your tokens, your farm, whatever, building something.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot of these games here, there's a lot about collecting. There's something very deep about that need to collect, that human psychology, to build something. And I think NFTs kind of play along with that. And sure, I think there'll be a bunch which just, fall, but then probably something remains, and I think it could be a big field in the future.
Yeah, something will remain, and that'll be big. But I think maybe 99% of it will fail and turn to dust. I don't know. It's not good. It's risky.
Sure.
You get the 1% that remains, that you'll be a lucky person.
Exactly. Alan, next question says, currently there seems to be more opportunities with small cap stocks than Tesla. Even Tesla up to 960 in 6 to 12 months, that's only about 30% up. Small cap can easily, or Bitcoin can easily have such a gain. How about taking profits and chasing some small cap stocks, using the gains to buy more Tesla? What are your thoughts about small cap stocks?
Yeah, I mean, I've already started to kind of explore kind of a little bit of that in my IRA account. I mean, I've sold a little bit, you know, of my Tesla stock there because there's no tax. And my main holding in my personal account and my my fund, and you know, I think Tesla's a great investment long term, and to take the large tax consequences of selling in my, you know, personal holdings is, I don't. Yeah, it's sort of like a safety thing to me, you know, like also, like, I think, well, I'm sure Tesla's going to be the largest company in the world by the end of the decade, sort of in my mind, you know. And I think in my IRA account, I'm trying to be a little more speculative. So I invested in SpaceX with it a little bit a while ago, we talked about, and there's some other private investments I'm kind of looking into potentially liquidating some of my Tesla for, you know, pre-IPO stuff. And then, you know, there's some small cap stocks. You know, I saw one person comment on a stock I was looking at personally. It's like, the ticker's TSNP right now. It's Humble Pay. And it's crazy. It's like a dollar, trading at a dollar, but it's got like a $3 or $4 or $5 billion market cap. Like, what? This is crazy. OTC said, but it's a fascinating story. And I've been studying it. And it's all like, you know, it still seems like super risky, even though it seems like there's a lot of stocks out there like that, you know, that you could pick from, and who knows what the winners will be. But, you know, some of these stuff, like that stock was like a, you know, it's gone up like 20 times or something like that in the last like 4 months already. Like, you know, so if you bought it like in the early fall, you would have made a lot of money. So there's a lot of opportunities like that. I probably missed the boat on it, you know, but there's a lot of other opportunities out there for small cap stocks and micro cap stocks. And it's a field I'm more and more curious about, but it's super high risk and you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. That's for sure. You want to diversify across a lot of these small cap stocks if you're going to do something with it, I think. What do you think about it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm actually, you know, getting more interested in this stuff as well. I think part of it is, I was just telling my wife earlier today, as Tesla reaches kind of a different stage of their growth, of their history, and, you know, with their company and stock, like, I kind of wonder personally, this is just kind of my own personal situation, but I'm like, I think I need to up my kind of risk reward type of ambitions. But Tesla as a stock and company could actually be lower risk than what I would want to be, or even reward in some ways. And I mean, it's obviously it's this complete personal, you know, type of approach, et cetera. But like, I'm kind of in the boat where I'm like, you know, I really need to 10X my entire, you know, like net asset work, like resources every 10 years minimum. And in order to do that, it's like, I have to do all this hacking, because at a certain kind of asset resource place, like the preservation mentality comes in so quickly, yeah. Where it's like, are you serious? Like, it's like hard to throw away, you know, let's say a lot of, you know, money into certain things. And so naturally there's a slowdown in kind of, you know, the pace of growth. And so I've been trying to figure out like what I can do. And one of the things is I'm like, okay, how can I increase risk in a smart way? You know, without just, I would say increased risk, but increased reward with, and moderately increased risk. You know, if I can increase risk a little bit, but increase reward a lot, then that's going to make sense in some ways. And I was thinking, well, I could explore margin and leverage, you know, because I'm like, okay, if Tesla's more of a safer stock now, maybe I could take margin. But then I'm like, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong, yeah. You know, with margin and leverage. And the other option is like, A, I could explore into more kind of faster growing, you know, opportunities, but that increases risk too. So it's like, you know, what portion, et cetera. But anyway, small caps is kind of one of those things. My thoughts are, I've been thinking the past couple months, is there any way to hack it where you can somehow, like, what's the problem with small cap stocks? I think one of the problems is people go into it without really doing full due diligence. It's like you hear a tip, you know, you just don't have a ton of time.
Limited information.
Yeah, you don't have a ton of time and you have limited information. You just kind of say, okay. And that's why it's hard to put a ton into it because you could lose it all. But if you put too little into it, it's not worth just spending all your time just chasing around, perhaps, you know, limited opportunities. So the past couple months, like if I get a tip or if someone contacts me, I'll, you know, see how deep their research is on a topic. And so, and also the field, I need to believe in the field. Like, for example, in battery supply chain, if I'm thinking, oh, there's some really interesting things here because, you know, Tesla's in it, all these batteries are into it.
You already have some knowledge.
Yeah. If someone has a small cap idea on that, I'm like, okay, tell me how much you've researched, how deeply you know this stuff. And so I say last month, I talked with someone and I just went back and forth like a ton. And I ended up doing like a Zoom call and grilling the person, like, how much do you know? And I'm like, okay, who are all the competitors in this field? Right. And then I researched it too. I'm like, okay, how much do you know about each competitor? So I'm just listing each competitor. I'm saying, what do you know about this company? Can you go off on an hour just, you know, really going deep into each competitor? Right.
Yeah.
And, and it's kind of a hack because if someone is really into it, like that deep,
then don't know it.
Yeah, it's a different level than just, oh, I'll throw some money into it, right? And I think that's kind of the hack I'm looking for. I'm like, hey, is there a way where I could like tap into real research? Or can I crowdsource some type of research into some of these smaller, you know, cap stocks that lower the risk profile tremendously, but yet the risk reward, the reward is still there. You can 10x within, you know, a couple of years without super high risk. I mean, of course, it's not going to be low risk, but it'll be lower than, you know, a lot lower than just throwing it, you know, because you've got that research background. But yeah, it's something that I'm fascinated by. And yeah, it's definitely, you know, I've taken a few positions, just small positions, but I'm still learning a lot about that area.
Yeah. It's just so much opportunity out there. It's like, what's the most efficient way to tackle it, right? And it seems like you have some good ideas and figuring out how to crowdsource it. Just how do you kind of put it together in an efficient way for you to, you know, funnel it the right way or something?
Yeah. I'm thinking like one of the biggest limitations to scaling, let's say, investments is research, is time. You know, you just don't have enough time to research every opportunity at a certain time or a certain place. And that's something that, you know, is kind of one of the biggest problems I'm facing, you know. It's just, how do you get, and that's the thing. It's like, if you can trust other research, you know, to a lot, that helps, but it's really hard to find really amazing research on, you know, these amazing opportunities, right?
Very hard.
Yeah. It's,
you're looking for like another, like, it's like you're almost looking for another like impossible thing because you compare, it's like, personally, I compare everything to like the Tesla opportunity. Like, when am I going to come along another opportunity that reminds me of what I felt like when I came across Tesla, you know, like, and it just seems like it may never, that type of opportunity might not happen. I have to settle for something that's not as good and be prepared to settle for other opportunities that aren't as good, but they can still have a much bigger reward than just buying and holding Tesla right now, for example.
Yeah, definitely. Next question is from Timothy. Clubhouse or YouTube? That's all. Did you actually see?
I think YouTube. Yeah.
Did you actually see Twitter Spaces at all? So Twitter has.
I've heard of it. I want to. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I haven't experienced it, but I'm so eager to see what that's about because I feel like that could disintermediate Clubhouse if it gets in early enough before Clubhouse has a whole huge, like, you know, content providers that don't want to leave.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it seems like a clone of Clubhouse, basically, right? It's the same audio kind of format. But definitely, if Twitter can move fast, definitely, you know, Twitter's got some interesting, I think, chance. But YouTube, like, I think YouTube needs to do something, you know, like get more of this, like, call-in, video call-in, audio call-ins from, you know, viewers. It's so obvious. But I think YouTube is, I don't know, man. They're moving slow
Clubhouse.
In certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, Clubhouse could be a huge thing if they suddenly brought in video. Like, you know, it seems like you could just combine these companies to create like the ultimate thing, like Zoom with Clubhouse with, you know, YouTube, and Twitter. You know, somehow you can combine those companies and make like the ultimate like social media recording, you know, thing, learning experience for everyone, you know, and eventually it'll come to that, but who's going to put that all together efficiently? Yeah. They all have their own unique stuff going on.
Definitely. Next question. Sanjay Matthew says Starlink valuation ? SpaceX valuation ? So SpaceX raised a round about a week ago, valuing the company at $75 billion. Just what, maybe 8 months ago, or I don't know, less than a year ago, of course. Actually, when you got in, you probably got in, yeah, what, May or June, was it, of last year?
I got in July before at a $38 billion valuation, okay, right before they raised it at $45 billion. I think they raised a round at 45. So I got in, yeah, it was, you know, 9 months ago, they did a round at $38 billion or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so people look at that and they say, hey, SpaceX is doubled in valuation, 38, let's say, to 75. But that doesn't tell the whole story, actually.
No.
Yeah, what happened was back just, you know, 8 months ago or so, there wasn't as much of a premium being put on SpaceX shares in the private markets. But now there's actually a huge premium being put on SpaceX shares, meaning it's kind of complicated, but it seems like investors are valuing SpaceX shares at well over $100 billion, you know? And that's, so the complicated story is, in the private market, there's certain opportunities to pick up SpaceX, but they're upcharging, you know, what SpaceX is going for, a significant amount. And this has only increased in the past 6 months. And it's to the point where $75 billion is not the real market cap value of SpaceX. Mm-hmm. They're just,
of course not.
Yeah. Yeah, they're so oversubscribed and the demand is so
high. Imagine if there's a SpaceX SPAC. Imagine if there's a SpaceX SPAC that came out suddenly. I mean, that thing would go through the roof, hundreds of billions right off the bat, you know.
What do you think? If SpaceX went public this next week, which obviously it won't, but what type of market cap valuation do you think it could get?
$250 billion is what I'd say. Yeah. Well, I don't know. That's what I think. Just on speculation, like based on what the market is like right now, you know, like the way that companies are getting these crazy valuations. Coinbase just did a round for $100 billion valuation on the private market. That's more than Goldman. That's about as much as Goldman Sachs is worth. Coinbase.
Gosh, I had an opportunity to invest in Coinbase.
Oh man.
It wasn't a big opportunity. It wasn't like so there's a company called Funders Club that I was, you know, doing some kind of small seed investing about 4 or 5 years ago. And so you could put in small amounts, like 10, 20, 30,000, whatever, into different seed companies. And one of them, one of them was Coinbase, which I was like right about to do. I mean, I invested in some other companies. It was one of those companies where I'm like, oh my gosh, just like Coinbase, you know? It's like you missed out, because that was like, they were super small back then, actually, four years ago. So
and I see like Cathie Wood and ARK, they're gonna do a SpaceX ETF, mm-hmm, or a space ETF, you know, but like if SpaceX like went public like next week, you know, they have like their Starlink and their rocket ship and all these things, like I hope they wouldn't limit themselves just to 10%, you know, max position of a single name. You know, same, like they would Tesla. Tesla is a conglomerate of businesses, but they can only put up 10% at the most. And Tesla, even though if Tesla split up its businesses, they'd probably put 10% in each one of them, you know. But so I hope they don't limit themselves with that 10% rule, because when SpaceX goes public, you know, I would think that's like half of all of space business, you know, like you'd want to put, you know, half your portfolio into SpaceX, you know,
exactly,
if you wanted to invest in space, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was telling my wife last week, if SpaceX went public, you know, right now, I think it would be well over $200 billion in market cap, you know, I mean, if not, you know, $300 billion or something crazy, just because, there's a lot of people wanting, you know, to, I think, invest into SpaceX. Next question, Ray Myers. How does Emmett handle the Pepper Family Foundation aspect? As in, does Emmett personally select where all the money goes to, or is there some sort of weighted voting mechanism for his fund's investors? What happens when there's no good prospects for deploying the capital? I'm curious because I'm trying to develop my own charitable giving method structure for my future fund that is in incubation phase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is still early days for me with the foundation. I donated stock to it at the end of last year, and I've donated it to kick it off, and then I've doled out some charitable contributions to a few different causes, the Portney Fund, the Children's Hospital you had mentioned, the Success Academy for charter schools. There's a human a nutrition organization trying to update nutritional guidelines, stuff like a few things like that, but it's still a small portion of the foundation's equity was donated so far. But I got the ball rolling, and you only have to the private foundation, it's a private foundation, you're only required to donate 5 or 10% of the value of the foundation per year. So I'm not in a huge rush to like donate all of everything I put into it already. And since I put in everything myself so far, I'm really just using my full discretion on it. But it's still early days. I still want to formulate a plan. So when I have investor capital from my hedge fund going into the foundation, based on the fees, because half the fees are going to the foundation, then I'm still going to have discretion, but I want to provide more transparency at some point so everyone can see. Maybe I'll have a website for the foundation so everyone can see where the money goes, whenever it goes, so my investors, they can see more about it. I'd want them to know more about where the fees that go to the foundation are going. And then I've also opened up the possibility if like some huge institutional investor comes in or some big investor that wants to put in more than like X amount, then if they want to put in more than like 5 million into my fund, which who knows if that'll ever even happen. But then I would be open to letting them use their to give me discretion on what foundation or what charities to donate their proportion of fees that are above that mark from my foundation. But it would have to go through like a vetting on my end. We have a little committee of like 3 people on my foundation, so we'd have to vet it to make sure that it's not some political charity or some controversial, polarizing charity that, so that's sort of what I've thought through so far. It's still early days, and it could just end up being mostly my capital of my fund. It's off to a good start this year, but if it, it's like a restaurant business, hedge funds don't usually last more than a couple of years. But if it succeeds to my greatest dreams, yeah, there's a whole lot of plans I'd like to make for it. But right now, you got to just get through this first 6 months or a year of having my fund going and operating well before I can like see it going much longer to like really develop my plans for the foundation.
So curious, was most of your contribution then in Tesla shares into your foundation?
Yeah.
And then do you still
Tesla
does the
shares.
foundation still have those shares?
No,
Okay.
I talked to my accounting firm and I wanted to keep it in shares, so I donated it at like 650 or six around that share price at the end of December. And I wanted to keep it in shares, but they're like, no, the IRS might frown upon it. You probably want to liquidate it to cash or put it in like a strategy that's much more conservative. That's not just the shares that get donated to it. It could raise questions. So I liquidated it all to cash and
Got
still
it.
just in cash. But at some point, maybe I'll put it in some kind of like I forget there's a term for it, but it's like it's a very you have to put it in a very conservatively run investment strategy if you don't want it in cash,
Yeah, got it. For those who aren't aware, so Emmett created a foundation called the Good Soil. Is it what is
The
it
Peppers Family Good
Pe
Soil
Okay,
Foundation.
Pepper's Family Good Soil Foundation. So, half of the fees that your hedge fund charges will go into that foundation, and that will be given to nonprofits. Definitely, it's awesome to keep up with that. I
Yeah,
know.
we've talked about other things like the potential grants of like, small businesses that are trying to get started. Like that's an avenue I want to keep open as maybe giving it from the foundation, and maybe that could be like if we did that and it turned out to be like really great, we could scale it quickly, for example, then maybe the majority of my foundation's equity would go to that, for example. Who knows? So I'm trying to keep it somewhat open. I have ideas, but it's always in motion sort of for now.
Awesome. I've been meaning to do a video on charitable giving where people can create a charitable giving account at any of the big brokerages, whether it's Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, and you can basically donate appreciated stock into one of those accounts, you'll get a tax deduction, and then you could use that money at your discretion to grant to various charities. And it's great because you can take your time actually with the grants. But yeah, I've been doing it for quite a while, and it's been great actually. Next question, we'll go on to Khan. I would like to set up a venture capital investing firm. Any thoughts on which niche or industry to focus to find potential unicorn startups? How would you guys set up your own venture capital firm?
Yeah, I actually was just talking about this with a friend of mine the other day, who's kind of more of an expert on the pre-IPO stuff. And he's been thinking about doing this for a long time, and he's got good insight and stuff. And I wouldn't mind at some point setting up a small fund with him, maybe, where, you know, you just look for all these startup tech companies that aren't public yet, you know, things that impact you on a daily basis, whether it's Airbnb way before it went IPO, or, you know, there's all these companies you could get opportunities to invest in potentially before they IPO. You know, some of them might end up failing and never IPO, but some of them get bought out or end up being, you know, big return. So something I think about, it's not my area of expertise right now, but there's a number of companies I like that aren't public yet. And it'd be great to have like a certain amount of money set aside to invest specifically in those types of companies. The SpaceX special purpose vehicle was an example, and there's another company I invested in recently, you know, and some others I'm looking at. But do you look into companies a lot, Dave, to invest in, or how would you do the venture thing? Would you do like seed start angel investing or what?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something I've been thinking about actually this past week. So like my personality and my kind of priorities or values were, I don't really like look forward to, for example, adding complexity to my life, and therefore, you know, bringing on funds or managing a fund, managing expectations, all this stuff is not something that I'm like really interested in per se. But this past couple of weeks, like, you know, I've been researching and actually trying to get into some more private companies, and it's like tough. Like I realize how difficult it could be to get into some of the companies you really want to get into, let's say pre-IPO. And so I'll give a few examples. So like there's this one company, they do kind of software coding in the browser, and I was like, you know, really interested in the company. They are raising, or I don't know if they're raising, but someone was saying something. And then I was like, you know, how do I get into this, you know, or what do I do? And it's complicated, you know? And so there's like, you have to like know someone like who's invested in them, or you have to know the management. Like people are vying to get in, you know? So it's not straightforward. Another example is, I was researching SpaceX a bit more, and researching all the people who are on the cap table, which is like the investors. And one fund, it's interesting, they're on the cap table, is like, you know, and they're also invested into Boring Company too. And so I'm like, how do they get into Boring Company? It turns out they've got a history, it seems like, with Elon. And like, you can get into Boring Company, you could probably get into Neuralink, but it's not easy to do. And so that's the only thing is I would be interested in a fund if it would allow me to get into the companies I want to get into, which right now maybe I'm having a difficult time. Like even Stripe, you know, it's tough to get in, but it's just an obvious, you know, big winner in my opinion, generational company. And so there are these different opportunities where, and that's the thing, it's like, because my capital is also allocated into Tesla mostly, it's like, you know, it is a bit tempting, you know, if I could, you know, raise some, manage some, I would go after just some of what I think is the next big winners, you know, and go after it big. And
it's got to be like an extraordinary opportunity to liquidate Tesla.
Exactly.
Or part of your Tesla.
Yeah. But there's so many opportunities where, you know, I'd love to get in. But I, again, my personality is I'm really reserved in terms of adding complications or complexity to my life. I like the simple, you know, managing my own funds, you know, no one to listen to, no one to question, you know, I just do what I need to do. And I feel I could, you know, if I'm patient enough and if I make the right decisions over time, you know, it'll all pay off, but we'll see. We'll go on to Clyde. Next question. How do you build patience and strong level of conviction? And then how do you identify 1,000x stocks?
I don't know how to, you got to be lucky to identify 1,000x stock. And
yeah,
exactly. Like Monster Beverage from a few years ago or whatever, you know, 20 years ago, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think patience and conviction are tough. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the missing virtues, patience, I guess, right? For me, I was lucky because I worked at a company where I wasn't allowed to trade during the day, you know, and I took it very seriously because my job was so important to me versus my Tesla stock at the time, you know, for many years. And so I didn't trade during the day, even though there was crazy news or crazy things. I knew I'd have to, so it kind of forced me to like take a breather and never trade during the day for so many years. And so I didn't panic sell like so many other people did on all the crazy headlines that would come, or the 30% down day, you know, like, or whatever, you know, you'd have a crazy down day and after the day is over and you get home, you're like, oh, I don't want to put in a sell order in now, just tank 30%. I got to wait till it goes up. And then it starts going up and you're like, oh, forget it. I'm not selling, this thing's going up, you know? So that helped me, I think. But you know, it's tough to just stick with a winner for so long, because like Netflix went down 80% 1 year or whatever, you know, there's like, you really have to have that conviction, you know? And the way to have that conviction is you really have to be a huge believer in the product and the company and the founder or leaders of the company. And those are things we worked on a lot for Tesla, for example, and maybe other people do it for Amazon or Apple. You know, some of these companies have cult-like followings for a reason. It's almost like you got to look for those companies that are ready to have a cult-like following, or that do have a early cult-like following, and see what the cult is coming from, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, let's actually group some more questions into this discussion. So Carl Davies says, top five beginner tips for investing. Aaron L. says, could you share the action items to continuously improve your investing skills? And R. says, what specific resources, books, websites, YouTube, et cetera, for learning how to identify investing opportunities using technical analysis and making profit? Obviously, we're not going to be able to go into, like, you know, hours and hours right now, obviously. But just some quick kind of thoughts off the top of my head is, I think a few things. First off, I don't think people generally are going to find big winners, whether it's a 10x, 100x, or 1,000x, whatever, unless they're really kind of looking for that. There has to be kind of this search for that, because they're hard to find. And so before you search for it, you kind of have to believe that it exists. And so it's helpful when you have some models or some examples. Oh, actually has happened, or some people have, you know, achieved X amount of gains, et cetera. The other thing is, I think it's important to be able to be in that position where you can take those type of risks, where, you know, I've mentioned this before, but have maybe two baskets where you have a safe basket, you're, you know, saving for retirement, it's safer. You can put another basket for more riskier plays, so you can go after those kind of bigger winners, right? And I think a lot of people, like, you're not gonna, like, that's the foundation. Those are some foundational things, you know? Like,
yes, for sure.
Have the infrastructure and a way to do it, and the motivation, desire, the goal to actually go after it. And I think a couple of things to define, I think, outside winners. One is I think to have a breadth of kind of understanding where the world is headed, to kind of ponder a little bit of a slightly more philosophical angle, you know? It's like, where are we headed, you know, mm-hmm. in the world as species, as whatever, like, where have we been? You know, there's a little bit of blend of history and philosophy and future and human nature as well. Like, human nature really is fascinating. I think people underestimate the role that human nature and behavior has in determining the future, you know? But there's so many, like, things that I think is there's a humanities to investing too, a human side. That's very thoughtful. But another thing is, I think it's easy to get swayed by media and articles where that paints the picture so decisively. This company is, you know, they're going this mm-hmm. company is like this, and you get programmed or swayed in your view. And what I like to do, what I think is actually super important, is to look at things more in terms of probabilities. So when I see a headline or I see someone say something about something, my first reaction is always to translate it. It's just how my brain kind of works. But I translate it, say, oh, that's 70% possible. 20%, that's yeah. not, you know, that
you can't do yes or no.
Exactly.
You don't want to be binary.
It's 20%, you know, yeah. where there's a really strong argument on the opposite, and 10% or something on that, where it's everything is taken less black and white, yes and no. And it's mm-hmm. it's all because people can sound like they know what they're talking about, but it really is a guessing game, you know, most yeah. everything. And I think
once, no one knows for sure.
Exactly. And you can have like expert this person or billionaire this person say it, but do they really know what they're talking about? They might know a certain percent of it, but how do you know everything? You don't. There's too much information. Yeah. There's too much change going on. There's too much stuff happening. So I think once like decoding that or deciphering that, you start to see, oh, you know, it's like other investors don't really have an advantage. Everyone's trying to figure it
everyone's
out.
Everyone's in the dark.
Everyone's in the dark, yeah. And you can interpret, you know, what people are saying. You can interpret CNBC or, you know, Bloomberg, whatever, yeah. Yahoo Finance, in a different light, you know. And
yeah.
you can kind of twist it and hack it to your advantage, where mm-hmm. They're not the experts, they're the guessers. Everyone's a guesser, and you can use that kind of to really try to find a big winner. Ultimately, it's your research, I think. It's your conviction. It's your digging into the products, the management, the owners, et cetera, that's going to determine kind of like
your actions.
Exactly.
If you can hold it.
Yeah. I think that's kind of a missing piece. A lot of people think, oh, investing is following the news, you know, following what's going on today in the market.
So psychological, really. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, it's not a distraction per se, but if you think that's the all in, like the all end, like is to follow the financial news, you know, and to be up to date, and you think that's investing, I think you're missing the core of it, or the bigger potential.
A lot of it is just like listening to authority. Like, you know, some people we're all programmed to listen to authority from a young age. And so we view financial media as the authority, like the people on CNBC and Bloomberg as the authority, you know, these billion-dollar hedge fund managers going on TV to talk about their book. You know, we view them as the authority on this stuff. And you know, if you follow the authority, it's usually not going to do as well if you can form your own hypothesis and act on your own thesis as opposed to the authority, you know. But then at the same time, you have to take that information into account and put probabilities on it, I think, like you said.
Yeah, definitely. Jamel says, could Tesla get into the HVAC industry, and could it be a big opportunity? Could they contribute carbon neutral hundreds of millions of homes that will have to have their existing systems replaced? And having this ecosystem like Apple did with phones could create extra value. So interesting side note is, I was just talking to someone a couple hours ago, a Tesla investor, and just a friend, and he was saying how he thinks, and this is not collaborated by any evidence, it's just more speculation, but in his opinion, he thinks that Tesla bought, I guess it was like 2,500 acres of land or something in Austin, right, for their gigafactory. Mm-hmm. But he's like, why do they need all that land? You know, they don't need all that land. And his speculation is they want to build homes eventually on that land.
I can see that.
Which is kind of interesting, actually. You know, I mean, again, it's not rooted in any evidence, just speculation. But I could see that because, hey, you've got this, you're bringing in, right, tens of thousands of jobs. And you are creating a huge market in itself. And they have the whole, you know, Reno Sparks example where it just blew up the real estate industry there. And so if you're going to do what you're doing in the industry, why not buy a bunch of land and build homes and maybe build a mini Tesla city or something, with completely green, solar roofs, HVAC, Tesla HVAC batteries, et cetera, just everything super modern, and you build the neighborhoods. Yeah. And another interesting thing was this friend here was saying how a lot of the land, I don't know how he knows this, but a lot of the land out there around the Gigafactory is optioned out already, meaning like the farms and different things, like people have bought options on the land already. It's like,
interesting.
It's hard to find anything that's not optioned around that area. It's like, who's buying these options? And well, I don't know. It's like, does Tesla have any options on this land out there? Or is it just developers? Yeah. It's so fascinating because there is huge amount of open land around the Gigafactory. And I'd love to see. Yeah, go for it.
Here's an idea. What if, how far is the SpaceX, building launch sites in Texas from the Gigafactory? Do you know?
I think about 5 hours or so.
Oh, so it's pretty far.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just thinking like, in the future, Elon thinks he's going to have a whole bunch of these going off all the time from Texas, probably, I'm thinking, and he's going to be colonizing Mars and transporting many thousands of people, every Mars opposition every 2 years or whatever. So, 10,000 people or more, maybe, and so maybe he's going to build some community for these for people that want to be part of this colonization, to live in together, to prepare together for their coming Starship trips to Mars, because you don't want to just have people like all over the world, like coming together randomly to suddenly go on the Starship together. You need them all to be working together on Earth first for a while before they all agree to go to, coordinate their efforts to go to Mars, I think. And then he's got dreams of sending tens of thousands of people, he wants to have 1 million people there by 2050 or something. Right. So it's a lot of people, and so maybe he's thinking something like that out. I don't know.
Yeah.
Crazy idea.
That's definitely interesting. I would love to have actually Tesla HVAC. I mean, here in this Texas storm, one of the issues is without electricity, the people can't heat their house, even if they have a gas heater, because the electricity is needed to start and to regulate whatever the furnace. And so even if you have gas, appliances or furnace, like you can't heat your house. And so it's terrible. I mean, if Tesla can make a super efficient HVAC system, not just air conditioning, but heating as well. Heating's gonna be tough, but I mean, if you can make it where it's just super efficient somehow, then you could just, completely get off of the grid and get off of gas, right? So if you get off of gas, you get off of, the grid, you basically just need sewer and water, right? But then you can do a septic tank too, right? If you have a well too, then you can get completely off the grid. But I would love something like that.
The HVAC, I don't know, I think that'll be great, but it's not going to be like a money printer for Tesla, like, self-driving is, or the Dojo neural networks or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Last question here is Khan says, if you would have found your startup today, what would it be?
Yeah.
What business do you think would have the most potential in the future? Which solutions would you try to solve? So I guess if you could start a startup, what would it be, I guess?
Yeah, I was thinking about this actually, and talked to a couple of people about it. I almost don't want to give this idea away because I feel like it's so obvious and you could make a fortune if you did it and it would be fun to do, but I'm not going to do it. So I might as well just talk about it. Someone will do it, I'm sure, in 2 or 3 years. Yeah. But basically using neural networks for sports, for play calling. And, I think there's a lot of really avid sports watchers that watch NBA, NFL games. And, one of the biggest points of contention is like, oh, those refs weren't fair. Those refs were, they were calling plays for, LeBron, like not calling the fouls they should over Shaquille O'Neal. He's not getting fouled, and they're calling all the fouls. You know, it's always been a complaint in sports. Always. You know, it's always one of those things like, am I really watching something honest here? Or, but if a company used neural networks to decide what's a foul and what's not, or what's a pass interference, what's not, what's a holding call in football and what's not, and then maybe they don't have to have an agreement of the NBA or NFL. They could just create their own independent website and real time be stating, you know, like, so you can follow along on your computer as like a hobby for fun as a sports watcher and be like, hey, let's see which ones are really, and maybe eventually announcers would catch on and mention it. Commentators would be like, yeah, this website is saying that does the neural network said it had 80% accuracy of their calls for that game, or this one had 30% accuracy, you know. So it could be, and eventually the leagues would catch on and maybe have to implement it or something like that in some way. But I feel like a company like that would be fun, because like you're using neural networks for like sports entertainment that, you know, I like sports, or I used to, you know, I haven't watched much this past year, but I think it would be kind of a really fun startup and probably not too difficult to do, because there's so much video available and you just need someone to label what's really a foul and what's not, you know, enough times where you can train the neural network to then label it itself. And then, you know, it sounds like it can be doable. I don't know. That's my idea.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not very good for society, but for like entertainment reasons, it would be cool. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wonder if some of that technology can be applied to other industries as well. I don't know. I mean, just or other applications, or yeah, beyond just sports. But
yeah, I think so. I think there's going to be a whole new set of industries coming out with these neural networks.
I mean, I'm sure some people are working on it, but you could probably do something along the lines also neural network sports coaching. So for example, did you ever play baseball as a kid?
I did.
Yeah. So like, let's say you're trying to learn how to hit a ball, and like the neural networks are analyzing your swing, right? And it could coach you just as like a person says, oh, you need to, you know, raise your elbow,
bend your knees, or
kind of don't swing like this way, like over the top, you know, you've got to go down more, you got to get the right arc in, right? That's key. But it could kind of coach you along because it's analyzing. Like another example is like golf is like such a crazy sport, but do you golf at all?
Yeah, I have. I'm not good. Yeah. I maybe a couple times a year.
But okay.
I like it because you're like out in nature, sort of here on the outside, and it's beautiful. But what about you? Do you golf?
Yeah, much? I mean, I haven't golfed in like 5 years, but I mean, there was a time where I was kind of into it, you know, playing like, you know, a couple times a week for, you know, 3 or 4 years. But what you could do is with neural nets, you could analyze your golf swing, right? But to the point where it can totally, you know, coach you exactly on what you're doing wrong and how you can, you know, make your swing better. But that type of stuff, I think, has potential, because you could do it across all sports, like volleyball or basketball. You know, like imagine if you're shooting a free throw and like neural nets can completely break down your shot and improve it.
Yeah.
Like in an hour.
And the
like,
voice is just talking to you in your head and the neural lace that neural.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you could just put in AirPods in there or something, or I don't know, or something, but I mean, that's definitely coming. This is probably whoever has the most ambition and who pushes it, you know, the hardest can do it. You know, there's an interesting concept of, I've been playing around with, which is, I think our economic system, also globalization and just how things are rewarded, it rewards people who are not very balanced in terms of life, like work-life balance. It really rewards those who go completely all in and just like focus, spend all their time and energy in, let's say, building the business and taking huge risks in terms of pushing it. Those type of businesses, like our market and system kind of rewards out in outsized ways because technology kind of amplifies their advantage because they get the network effects. They get, you know, the brand recognition, they get the users, they get economies of scale, et cetera. So it kind of is, it's, I don't want to say unfair advantage, but I think that's why a lot of times in today's society, the companies that, let's say, reach, you know, velocity and become huge companies usually are driven by very, very focused, hyper driven entrepreneurs.
Obsessive, probably.
Obsessive, yeah.
Just like night and day, 24/7, thinking about that mission of that company.
Exactly. And the question though is like, like in a way, if you're strictly looking at size of business and ambition and also certain mission and goals, it could actually completely make sense, you know? And I'm not gonna say it doesn't, but in another angle, I don't know if that's for everyone either, you know, to live like that and to, you know, it's definitely.
Maybe in your 20s before you want to have a family, but like once, if you get old enough, you want to have kids and stuff, it's hard to dedicate your whole life to a business, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There's definitely trade-offs, I think. It's been fun chatting as always, Emmett. Anything else going on in your mind or?
I don't think. I mean, I feel like there was something else I wanted to talk about, but I mean, it's just been a real crazy, you know, last 18 months, and 2021 seems to be on the verge of getting better. I know a lot of people keep asking about like how to hedge or like what do you do when you think a downturn's coming. You know, there's always fear in the market, and it's just always going to be fear. People worry about the government printing money and it's going to backfire. But I feel like the markets, no one knows when it's going to tank again or when it's going to overcorrect. You know, it could keep going up another 200% before it drops 20-30% again. You know, who knows? But on the side of the government, people are always saying, oh, the government's, that's why Bitcoin is going to, you know, make the US dollar obsolete and all this stuff. But in the history of the world, governments have, you know, people have complained about the currencies, you know, and the manipulation of taxes and all that stuff of their governments. You know, it's nothing new. So it's always existed. It's always been there. There's just more transparency and more, you know, emotional reaction, you know, kind of, there's just more transparency with the way the World Wide Web works, you know, and more news getting out to the masses quicker and clickbait headlines and get people riled up and stuff. And so it's hard to know whether like the government we're in now is really stepping out of their lane more than they governments have historically or not. You know, like, is this just the norm of what governments do, printing money when they feel like they need to, or, you know, manipulating the money supply? And it just seems like it's probably the norm. That's what I think. And people get all crazy about it, but I think there's nothing too stressed out to be, you know, too stressful to be about it. And I don't know. That's just one thing I was thinking of when I see so many people complaining about it all over the place on Twitter and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. What do you think about that? I mean, I know you've been concerned about the printing of money too. And do you think it's more than historical, what's going on historically? Or do you think this is like, you know, worse than anything ever in the past, or
par
for the course?
I mean, I have some, okay, so some thoughts are, I'm not a fan of, that's one of the issues, is I see so many angles to it, you know, especially like, you know, I was doing a deep dive into modern monetary policy or theory and MMT, and just this whole concept of some economists saying, hey, you know, printing money, you know, it's okay because it's going to stimulate the economy and that's the whole point, et cetera. But, I like to look at it where you got to kind of take in all sorts of angles and you got to see kind of the pros and cons and et cetera. But I think the way I look at it is there's a bigger issue, and it's when a country enters a point where they kind of lose their competitive advantage. And for example, on a company level, let's say, you know, your revenues are shrinking, you know, and, or they're not growing that fast anymore. Your expenditures are growing, you know, it's just like your company isn't very, you know, as profitable or lucrative, right? The growth prospects aren't there as much. Like in similar ways, I think countries follow, you know, their own kind of cycles, and life cycles in a sense. And, Historically, there hasn't been a country, obviously, that has been, the world power for, forever, obviously. And so the bigger question is the U.S. losing, some of that from a historical level, that competitive advantage it had? And is some of that weakness starting to just show up in monetary policy, in the need to prop up the economy by printing money? Like, is that just more of a symptom of a bigger type of trend going on? That's more of a decade, century, it's kind of 100, 200 year perspective. If you have a strong company that's or a strong country that's on the rise, do you really need to be constantly, trying to print money to stimulate the economy? It seems like there's a certain life cycle where, at maybe the second half of your second half, or even the last third of your, let's say, world dominance or hegemony, in a country, you're kind of relying on certain tactics or methods, right? And I'm not going to say those methods are wrong, because they actually could actually help stimulate the economy. It could actually work in certain cases. But on the flip side, I think you're introducing some risks into the system. But were those risks already there because of the declining, let's say, competitive advantage of your country as well? So there's a lot of question marks here. But overall, though, like, when you look at the global situation, the global economy, you have billions of people joining the middle class just, in recent decades, and joining more in upcoming decades. Technology is, in a way, leveling the playing field. Education, et cetera, language is not a bigger barrier as before. So you've just got a lot of tailwinds globally, where, the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, we're going to see, I think, immense amount of global growth. And there's plenty of opportunities.
Innovation.
There's going to be, yes, innovations, technology pushing the
It's
envelope.
accelerating.
Yeah, so I'm not a pessimist by any means. We're going to see, it's just, you have to navigate these waters, I think,
Yeah, it's
with
like a
the
balance or
right head on.
something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense.
All right, Emmett, thanks for chatting again, and we'll be in touch again. And yeah, have a
Yeah, for
great
sure.
weekend. Yeah, take care.
All right.